You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 16th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jared Shanahan and Zandarka Kirti, authors of States of Incarceration, Rebellion, Reform, and America's Punishment System. And later in the show, Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute will be joining us to discuss the anti-China hysteria in Washington. Meanwhile, the death toll from the devastating earthquakes in Turkey and Syria have topped 40,000 people. The UN has launched a $1 billion appeal for humanitarian aid. Republicans might be zeroing in on their hostage for debt ceiling negotiations. Food stamps for the poor. Work requirements for food for our poorest.
Vampire dinner.
Tesla has fired dozens of employees at its Buffalo plant one day after those workers announced plans to organize. To unionize, I should say. It must be a coincidence.
Saving us from free speech. Saving free speech for us. Those workers probably really hated free speech, so.
Yeah, I mean, good he cracked down on that. On the other side of the state, Kathy Hochul was just dealt yet another humiliating defeat. Hector LaSalle's nomination to be New York's top judge shot down in a full Senate floor vote, with every Democrat except one voting no. She's very bad at this. Republicans in the House have hired bank lobbyists to help kill Biden's proposals on capping bank fees for customers. Norfolk Southern ghosted East Palestine residents, who organized the town hall after the environmental disaster that the freight rail crash caused. Rail workers who work on these kinds of trains are also sounding the alarm in the press, showing that they knew in advance how dangerous that train was. Barbara Lee officially filed paperwork to run for Senate in California, a confusing decision. Seems like Matt Gaetz won't need that preemptive pardon from Trump after all. The DOJ says it won't pursue sex trafficking charges against him. That's what he was seeking from Trump. The FDA appears poised to approve Narcan for over-the-counter use. The Buffalo supermarket shooter, who killed 10 people in a largely black neighborhood in a racially motivated mass murder, has been sentenced to life in prison without parole. And lastly, a grand jury has indicted the father of the Highland Park shooter, who allegedly helped get his son a gun license despite his son's record of violent threats. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. I hope everyone's having a lovely Thursday. It's 60 degrees for the second day in a row here in New York. And that's quite concerning. It's February 16th. So there's that. I also saw that the, we can maybe complain about the weather later. That's later in the show. But it's just like insane that we've not had any snow yet, and scary. So
there was like some statistic about that, right? It's like the first winter like in a long time, yeah, maybe ever, that we've had like zero, little to no snowfall at all.
Yeah, it's probably fine.
Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't worry about it.
Sweater weather, let's go. Springtime.
It's not even sweater weather.
T-shirt weather, let's go.
I have my like winter coat, but without the like main lining in it. And mm-hmm. I was walking in today and just sweating my back started sweating because like, it was too warm.
It was hot walking
right. I was wearing a jean jacket and I was sweating coming in. I went outside to smoke a joint last night, and I was in shorts. So, great. Regardless, with that said, we'll get into some fun news stuff here, because I don't think Nikki Haley's presidential run is off to the best start. Because
she said she wouldn't cross her president. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, sorry for her. It's also just not really a presidential run in my view. It's a vice presidential run. I think she knows that. But at the very least, I still would have been a bit more prepared than she is, seemingly, to differentiate herself as a candidate, because she still has to keep up with the fiction that she is a presidential candidate. And she is making the rounds on Fox News. Here she is on Sean Hannity. Hannity asks her, basic question, how are you different from the party's last president, Trump? She's got no answer.
If you had to delineate where, say, you and President Trump differ on issues, where would you start?
Well, first, let's say in reference to Whoopi, you know, the thought of me getting into the race makes the liberals' heads explode.
All right, pause it just for a second.
Sorry, real quick. Whoopi Goldberg, the co-host of The View, that is how she responded, by saying, let me just first address View co-host Whoopi Goldberg's comments about me.
Is this her first exclusive announcing her presidential run, or one of her first kind of interviews at least? And Hannity's program gets a lot of views. So this is, for most people running a presidential campaign, this is an opportunity to really brand yourself in the eyes of the American people. And she starts with, first of all, Whoopi Goldberg.
It's just like they, it's like how they get fixated on like the Grammys and all this like frivolous BS because they don't want to actually like address real things.
Yeah,
and it's just like, it's a compulsion.
Even her, who's supposed to be the more established, right, esteemed Republican who's above it all, she's down to crap on Whoopi Goldberg.
But yes, you're right. She basically had the ad rollout Tuesday, delivered a speech in Charleston on Wednesday, where, all again, didn't mention.
Or she praised like some like anti-Semitic pastor.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, right.
Didn't. Yeah.
I forgot about that. Yeah, we can discuss that after she's done. You know, we got to get the Whoopi stuff out of the way. Sorry, the meat of the conversation.
If you had to delineate where, say, you and President Trump differ on issues, where would you start?
Well, first, let's say in reference to Whoopi, you know, the thought of me getting into the race makes the liberals' heads
the
explode.
Liberals.
And so I welcome it because it shows we're doing something right. You know, when it comes to what we're looking at now, listen to the first 20 minutes of your show. Look at everything that's wrong in this country and tell me we don't need new leadership. But the difference is we need new generational leadership. We have to leave the status quo. We have to leave this chaos behind. And we've got to start talking about the future. You need a Washington outsider that's going to come in and say, yes, I understand that families are having to pay more to make their grocery bill. I understand that they are worried about their children who may never get back from what they lost during COVID. I understand the fact that when someone's factory leaves town, he's worried that his future went with it. I understand that you should not have Americans looking up at the sky and seeing a Chinese spy balloon looking back at them. This is insanity. And what we need are a lot of changes. First of all, we've got too many politicians in D.C. that are past their prime. We have term limits in Congress. We need to see
term limits.
You're a politician.
I'm
not a politician.
Any elected official over the age of 75. We've got to stop the spending addiction that is happening that
austerity
is causing
cool
inflation to go up. And we need to start realizing that we don't need our politicians getting on TV and talking. We need the people in D.C. doing, and we need to spark a fire up under them. And that's what I'm willing to do. And if you are tired of losing because we've lost the last 7 out of 8 popular votes for president, we're doing something wrong. If you're tired of losing, then join me and go to Nikki Haley.
That's the first thing.
Because we are going to go and fight for.
Sorry, but like that's the very first actual thing is like Trump's a loser.
Yeah, right. Well, that's.
But they have to like couch it in after all of this BS.
How can you maintain that he's a loser once you've bought into the election denial? You can't square that circle. And you know, she thought that she could be a little bit more hands-off with that kind of stuff. But then you've lost the base. Then you're a rhino. Then you're not truly a part of the MAGA world. And so without them, this is what you're doing. You're auditioning along the margins for a VP slot for DeSantis. That's her role here. But that was basically it, right? That was the one kind of attempt at differentiation. But there's a second part, right, here where she's asked once again by Sean Hannity, who, let me remind you, January 6th texts reveal how deeply embedded Hannity is in Trump world on speaking basis with a lot of Trump's closest advisors. So interesting choice of hers to go on Hannity, who I think is more in the bag for Trump than a lot of others. Asked again by Hannity, okay, but policy-wise, not just the loser element, what's the difference between you and Trump? She's got nothing.
Let me go back to my original question, though, because anybody that is looking or seeking a nomination, you're going to be comparing and contrasting your policy positions, your views, what direction you want to take the country with your competitors. Right now, there's former President Trump is the only other candidate for the nomination. We expect many others, maybe even Mike Pompeo, who was on earlier in the program today. Where do you see, if you see, policy differences beyond what you mentioned, which are generational differences? What specific policy areas would you say part with Donald Trump?
What I am saying is I don't kick sideways. I'm kicking forward. Joe Biden is the president.
What
the?
This, okay, this is a.
Why are you running against him?
This obsession with kicking. This was also in her initial.
When you kick with heels, it hurts more.
Yeah. And
like
she's
that.
Like, and I'm kicking backwards, too. Or it's like a donkey kick.
That's her Democrat.
That's why you're a rhino. Because
yeah,
you're
sounds
too,
like a Democrat.
Too much like a donkey. And you're an ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of. I mean, mostly people stomp or they kick forward, but she's really into this backwards kicking thing. There's also a metaphor there, kicking the door slamming it shut with her foot for people behind her.
There's also this, like her statements about Trump are so funny, like how she tries to play at both sides. In January 25th, 2021, he said, we should not go back to the Republican Party before Trump, noting that people he brought into the GOP. She added that Trump's actions on Election Day were not his finest, but opposed his impeachment. She said of the Democrats in Congress, they beat him up before he got into office. They're beating him up after he leaves. I mean, at some point, I mean, give the man a break. I mean, move on.
Right. And she does not have the guts to actually do anything meaningful in this primary based on that complete pussyfooting around everything. But this is an example also, if we could just pull up this thread from the historian Seth Kotler, who recognized a figure from her presidential launch who she referenced, Pastor Hagee here. And this is just a good indication, if we can put this up here, Seth writes, Haley's choice to align herself with a figure like Hagee is a good indicator of how far right the self-described moderate and reasonable wing of the GOP has gone. Back in 2008, John McCain chose to distance himself from Hagee after first courting him because Hagee had a habit of saying that Hitler was part of God's plan to chase the Jews from Europe and send them fleeing towards Palestine.
I'm going to have to ask Candace Owens if that's problematic or not.
I guess it's just the Hitler of the month, according to Taibbi. I'm researching Walter Huss, a Holocaust-denying Christian nationalist preacher with neo-Nazi ties who became the chair of the Oregon GOP in 1978. He was a big fan of Hagee's book back in the 1990s. There's just some material from the archives. We don't need to check all of that out, but you guys get the gist. Back in 2008, Bruce Wilson brought to light Hagee's extremism that forced McCain to cut ties. But some more detail about this sort of thing, things Hagee believes in, which apparently Nikki Haley considers fine. It's New World Order stuff. It's just lots of anti-Semitic extremism. And far-right extremism. But this is supposedly the moderate who's going to bring in the Trump voters. And there's really no half measures with the MAGA people. You got to be Trump or you got to be aligned with Trump. And there's this denial by the Republican establishment and even like media,
mainstream press,
that is the path forward to a Republican nomination. They're trying to will into existence a person who can cynically really lie to the Republican base and give them what they want. Someone like Nikki Haley, which is that raw racism, bigotry, xenophobia. While behind closed doors, in private, their private position being something a bit more respectable. And I just don't think that you're able to pull off that magic trick in the year 2023, let alone going forward.
Yeah. I mean, and also, like, this is the dynamic of how, like, the center and mainstream launders this sort of far right stuff into, like, sort of, like, if Ilhan Omar had praised this freak, it would be leading every cable news thing, and the entire party would melt down.
So it is, she's going nowhere, but the Republican Party is in a bind, at least when it comes to the presidential race, because they're unable to be a mainstream party, but the candidate that's going to come out of this primary is unable to have success unless it goes even further right, further into Trump land, and further right than where someone like Nikki Haley is, which by, as the historian here points out, by any standard from 15 years ago would be quite far right. These are the bedfellows that they have now, and they're going to go down with the ship.
Yeah, they can't say no to this stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Jared Shanahan and Zandarka Kirti. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by the co-authors of States of Incarceration, Rebellion, Reform, and America's Punishment System, Jared Shanahan, who is a professor of criminal justice at Governor State University, and Zandarka Kirti, who is also a professor at Loyola University Chicago, professor of criminology and criminal justice. Thank you guys so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. I never know when co-authors come on who to direct this first to, but I guess, Zandarka, we'll start with you here. You open your book speaking about what you call the George Floyd Rebellion, which I love that phrasing there, because the demonstrations were acts of rebellion and acts of abolition, as you discuss. Why was that reframing so important for you to emphasize?
Thank you. That's such a good question. And I think, something that Jared and I really wanted to be intentional about was the fact that we are, of course, a lot of people are going to be reading this book 3 years later. They're reflecting on the rebellion 3 years after it happened. And there's a lot of liberal amnesia just about what actually did happen during that summer of 2020. So we wanted to frame it as a rebellion, because that's what it was, right? It was the most spectacular form of self-activity of millions of people, who took part in the rebellion in terms of direct action, in terms of the diversity of tactics, and it constituted one of the largest examples of collective action in recent history, and one which was very militant and which rejected not only police violence, but the very society that police violence maintains, right?
Right. Well, that militancy, that is also something that you both emphasized there. And that was a significant portion of demonstrators and people just involved in this action. But there also were a lot of well-meaning liberals involved, right? You know, coming out. So Jared, I'll turn to you. Do you think that was kind of overemphasized, or do you think that helped or hurt the movement, that broad in scope?
Thanks for having me on. Early in the rebellion, the critic Idris Robinson emphasized that one of the ways that the state and the ruling class were going to try and defeat the rebellion was by redefining it within the bounds of liberal democratic participation. But that doesn't mean that the participation of liberals was bad. In fact, it was amazing. You know, the participation of millions of people from all different kinds of political backgrounds actually made it so great and made it so effective, and also enabled a lot of the militancy that occurred. If you read the Siege of the Third Precinct in Minneapolis, which is an excellent article, it was just published in the George Floyd Uprising anthology that's coming out or came out on PM Press. It's a firsthand account by somebody who was there when they burned down the Third Precinct. And the author emphasizes that a diversity of tactics made this possible, including the participation of a lot of people who considered themselves nonviolent protesters. So I think as we look back on 2020, it's really important to emphasize that a whole lot of people came together, perhaps for different reasons, right? And perhaps they had a different analysis, but they ended up engaging in a sustained and very serious challenge to the status quo in the United States.
And that kind of militancy that you described there, what are the lessons that you hope the country learns from that? Taking that and zooming out and applying it more to incarceration in all of its different systems, as broadly as possible?
Well, I can say real quick that we saw how quickly the national narrative around policing and incarceration changed in a few weeks of large numbers of people out in the streets engaging in direct action and confrontational tactics. And we can compare that to the 2.5 years since, and look at what's been accomplished during that time by the usual suspects in the nonprofit sector and liberal democratic politics. And I would say we have a pretty clear example that direct action gets the goods.
Mm. Right, for sure. Let's turn to other parts of your book as well, where you kind of dive into the history of mass incarceration in this country. Because besides the fact that we literally jail more people on this planet than in any other country, what makes incarceration in the United States so unique? Jandarka, I'll turn to you with that.
Yeah, sure. That's a really good question. And I think something that there's a lot of conversations about it, so it's amazing that that's also happening. And I think that's also a result of the rebellion. People are way more interested now in talking about incarceration, police violence. So mass incarceration is usually the term that's given to define this experiment that American institutions embarked on starting in the 1970s that led to an exponential increase in the number of people who are jailed and incarcerated in jails and prisons in the United States. And there's like all these charts you could look up online, but it seems that the U.S. imprisonment rate was relatively steady up until the 1970s and 1980s. And then we see this huge jump of, you know, up to the upwards of over 200%, 300%, 400%. So mass incarceration usually refers to this and also refers to the stark racial disparities in the criminal justice system. When we look at African Americans' incarceration rate is oftentimes 5 times or 6 times that of whites. Latinos is about 3 to 4 times of whites. So we also see a system that's very disproportionately racialized, right? However, something that Jared and I are really clear about, and this is, again, we're not unique. We, part of writing this book and thinking about this has been in conversation with other scholars, other activists who are also saying this, is that the focus on mass incarceration alone does not take into account the ways in which the criminal justice system has become one of the main ways in which people experience the state today, right? That it goes beyond jails and prisons. It goes to the most quotidian police encounter, the traffic stop, right? It also expands to probation and parole. So it's really kind of an expansive system of various various institutions that seek to stigmatize, surveil, and punish the poor in America.
Right. And I mean, it's all, your focus as well on it, and I'll turn to Jared here, on it being a system of class domination that also manifests itself in those kind of, along those racially stratified lines, is a really important emphasis. And you also highlight how for the working class in this country, there's kind of a unified, shared experience for many people where, their interactions with the state have been kind of, reserved for the carceral system. What does that do to an entire section of the country when that is the dominant form of interaction?
I'm glad you brought up the overlapping experiences of race and class that characterize how the punishment system is lived. I think it's really important to emphasize that any political framework that forces you to choose between race or class is just a complete analytical dead end. We tried our best to reconstruct how the carceral state throughout history has functioned as an explicit tool of class domination. And I think it's really interesting to note here that the prison and other related disciplinary technologies that currently dominate American life were not developed in response to unfree labor in the American South during slavery. They were developed as disciplinary tools for free labor in Western Europe in the early days of capitalism. On the flip side of that, however, the particular racial division of labor in the United States has worked and developed in tandem with the growth of mass incarceration to produce a distinctly racialized form of class domination. And so, unfortunately, the reconciliation of race and class in this analysis does not fit on a bumper sticker, right? It doesn't make for a great slogan just quite yet. But I think we tried our best to understand race as a process that's constantly being created and recreated within class society at the same time as the punishment system and other modes of class domination are developing and evolving, right? And so what this means in terms of possibilities for solidarity across the lines of race that American society is organized along, right, is that there are a whole lot of white people who actually experience the carceral state in an extremely negative way. At the same time, we need to be attuned to the very particular experience of African Americans in particular, who constitute such a disproportionate number of the punishment system's victims.
Yeah, Jean Darka, I apologize. I got tongue-tied for a sec. Can you expand on that point there about it being a system for free labor? Because I feel like there's a people don't fully understand that those systems very much do remain, that there are many prisons and jails in this country that still essentially exploit their prison population even further for their labor. And I think that that's a great example of how intrinsically tied this is to capitalism.
Yeah. So thank you. I really appreciate you asking that. And I think So I want to say a couple of things. And we take a lot of time in the book to give a very accessible account of how can we think about crime and punishment, race and class in relationship to capitalism. And, and again, it's building on the work of a lot of scholars and activists, but we really want it to be in an accessible way, in a way to offer also folks that have been politicized by the last decade of struggles, continuous political language by which to talk about this, right? So I think it's a mistake in many ways to see mass incarceration while it's well-intentioned, right, to see it as like, you know, after the 70s, man, like it just, everything just went wrong. But actually the history of punishment, historically has been really important for capitalism, right? So we take some time to talk about how crime, right? Even like Marx and Engels talked about this, right? Was an important way to form, punishment was kind of a reaction to crime, but it was a way to force working people to accept really crappy jobs, right? Because the alternative was a jail and a prison cell, right? So it's no coincidence that even today we see the criminalization of everyday life, from, let's say, loitering to homelessness to any kind of non-wage work, right? So criminalization and punishment have a long history in its uses by capitalism, right? By the state, the ways in which, for instance, a lot of times the liberal democracies give this illusion that the law is transparent, is equal, right? That the police are there to protect people. So I think we really need to kind of be critical of that and denaturalize a lot of those categories. But I think kind of to bring it back to the current moment, it's historical, right? So it's not just about this present moment. But there's a way in which I think if you watch documentaries like 13th, which I really love, right? It's a great introduction to this topic. You get away feeling like there's private prisons in the United States, right? That the problem is private corporations and the problem is that prisoners are being used for their labor, right? And they're not being paid for it. So the reality is that only 12% of American prisons are privatized. Most people who sit in jails and prisons across America are not doing much work. They're sitting there. They're literally being warehoused in some ways. They're being quarantined, right, from the rest of society. So I think we need to have more nuanced understandings of how it is that criminalization and punishment work. The last thing I'll say, especially in an era where so many people after the 70s have been thrown out of the labor market, right, where the kind of jobs that people had in the past no longer exist, right, and mass incarceration, in many ways, we argue, as others have, is really a response to this crisis of capitalism, this crisis of work, this crisis of deindustrialization, right?
Right. That's a really necessary reframing there, because there is sometimes like this liberal tendency to tweak exploitative systems as a way to make them, like, say, smarter or smart policing, right? Which is actually what we just saw. That Scorpion unit was a highly targeted crime unit. And there are a bunch of different impulses that just dance around necessary, more radical changes there. And the focus, honestly, on private prisons, as opposed to the system of imprisonment, is one of those. Where do you think that comes from, that overfocus? Is it the nonprofit industrial complex that you describe in your book? Is it just kind of this attempt to maintain our current punishment system and not really look hard at what the work that really needs to be done? Where do you think that impulse really comes from, Zhandarka?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. I don't know. I teach a documentary, and these are conversations I have with my students who are like, America's punishment system is wrong because, like, prisoners are being made to work. And I'm like, guys, it's wrong because people are being sent to prison, right? But I think the impulse is to blame corporations, right? It takes away a lot of the focus from the state, right? The fact that most people are actually locked up in jails and prisons or being by harassed by the police. And these are all state institutions, right? Of course, we could get into the role of like the nonprofits and kind of these institutions in the punishment system. But the problem is the state. And I think for Jared and I, this is a really important intervention that abolitionists make, right? That they argue that the system is not broken, right? You know, it's not that, you know, after the 1970s, the system just became really messed up. I mean, there's some truth to that, of course, but the system is built and is working the way it's intended to work, right? That there are important ruling class interests, right? There's important state interests in criminalization, in punishment, and that the object of where we should be directing our energy to is the state. Right,
exactly. And I want to ask you a bit more, Jared, about your work with Rikers, because that is, we're here in Brooklyn. A few weeks ago, we had a guest on specifically to talk about Rikers and the work on closing it, which is the idea that it's still not closed is beyond me. Jared, do you mind just talking a bit about how your work on that, your research on that as well, fits into your overall thesis about prison abolition? And also, you know, if you don't mind touching on how the death of Khalif Browder kind of influenced some of the work in that space.
Sure. Well, the book that I think you're referring to, Captives, is dedicated to Khalif Browder. And I chose to do that because he was a uniquely courageous person who stood up to the punishment system that was trying to use the violence and horror of Rikers to force him to cop a plea to something he didn't do. It's very common. And he also stood up to the system of brutality and coercion that characterizes life behind bars in New York City and many places where the most powerful gangs work with the most powerful gang, the guards, right, and their union, which organizes them. And so the work that I've done historically on Rikers actually ties into a lot of what Jana was just talking about, in the way that the progressive wing of the ruling class is always trying to demonize anybody but themselves. And they're always looking to moments of crisis like this and trying to redeem capitalism. They're trying to separate out the regressive, retrograde, violent, racist, counterproductive elements of the ruling class, who they actually really hate, right? From themselves, the forward-thinking social engineers, you know, who populate the Ford Foundation and who funded the Close Rikers campaign, you know, who pumped money into places like the Institute for Local Governance at CUNY, right? So my Rikers history was an attempt to basically weld the ruling class back together and to say that these institutions of punishment and coercion that we all love to hate in the present day were as much the product of progressive reforms as they were the mean law and order regressive right wingers who came later. In doing so, I build on the work of Naomi Murakawa in particular, who's done some excellent scholarship around this, and of course Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And in the process, I showed that the New York City ruling class has been divided, right, episodically throughout its history over the question of how to maintain class domination, right? Do you do it with an influx of social spending, public assistance, public employment, public housing, or do you do it with the use of police and prisons? But at the end of the day, and we see this in moments of great upheaval from below, like 2020, like 2014, like 2011, both sides of the ruling class, when they're threatened by upsurge from below, reveal themselves to be very much part of the same project of capitalist domination, right? So as much as we like to imagine that our favorite progressive, you know, politicians are our friends, right? Or they're cool. We want them to like us. I want AOC to read my book and talk about it in Congress, right? They're very much a part of that same system, right? And focusing only on the evil Republicans, you know, who have said the latest offensive media stunt comment, right, really distracts from the totality of capitalist domination.
Well, I hear that. Jared Shanahan, Jandarka Korti, authors of States of Incarceration, Rebellion, Reform, and America's Punishment System. Thank you guys so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Jake Werner. We are back, and we are joined now by Jake Werner, co-founder of Justice is Global, historian and researcher for the Quincy Institute. Jake, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this latest escalation in China hawkery.
Yeah, great to be here.
So let's talk about the balloon, right? The very scary floating balloon that caused such hysteria in the weeks before. If you don't mind tracking, giving a little bit of a rundown of what went down with this Chinese balloon, the reaction, the fallout as well, including Tony Blinken canceling his diplomatic trip to China.
Yes, well, the balloon showed up on all of our horizons just as Tony Blinken was about to set off to China for the first meeting, the first visit of U.S. Secretary of State to China in over 3 years. And as you said, the biggest fallout from the appearance of the balloon, in my opinion, if not every Republican member of Congress's opinion, is that visit was canceled. But the balloon appeared over Montana, and it floated across the continental United States over the next couple of days. There was immediately a fairly hysterical reaction in Washington in response to this violation of U.S. territorial sovereignty and to the idea that the Chinese government might be spying on the United States. So there were members of Congress and commentators, op-ed writers screaming about this. The Biden administration said the balloon poses no danger. It is neither physical danger to Americans, nor are we worried about its intelligence gathering capabilities, where it's at, where it's going. So they waited until it had crossed the United States and was over the Atlantic, and then they shot it down with a single missile. So just one, whatever, hundreds of millions of dollars missile brought down that balloon.
We could use a pin. How about an arrow? Like that might have, you just pop it, and then that might have been more effective, right? Then it stays intact. I think
some members of Congress may be working on developing multi-billion-dollar research agendas to figure out how we can develop a more effective set of pins.
I mean, harpoon technology, we really need to be getting into that. As you say, this was incredibly hysterical and funny, too, but hysterical in a dangerous way. Because this is the exact time, if tensions are increased, that we should be having diplomatic visits. But I'm curious really about the political maneuvering by someone like Blinken and the Biden administration here. Because there's no doubt that regular spying and surveillance happens on both ends, from China on the U.S. and the U.S. surveilling China. And yet this was decided, it was important that this was made into a big deal. how do you think that went down, if you were to speculate? I mean, the balloon was spotted, and I guess my guess is that the Biden administration saw it as an opportunity to look tough. What's your read on it?
I think it wasn't so much an opportunity to look tough as they felt forced into that position. Both the U.S. government and the Chinese government have been looking to improve the relationship at least a little bit, because it's sort of been spiraling downwards and seems to be moving towards very serious conflict over the last 5 years. That's obviously started under the Trump administration, but the Biden administration continued most of Trump's policies, if not all of the racist rhetoric, and added some of its own policies that actually made the anti-China moves of the United States more effective. And China has responded in provocative ways, and so the relationship has deteriorated to the point where there is now sort of legitimate war scares happening on both sides, and that I think alarmed people in both capitals, and people in both governments want to avoid conflict. They're not looking for a war. There's a lot of speculation around the balloon that this had been sent by the Chinese government to test the United States or something. Or alternatively, there's a lot of speculation that the U.S. government had made the presence of the balloon public because it wanted to mess up the summit between Blinken and his counterparts in Beijing. I don't really buy the speculation on either side of that. The indications all point to the people at the top levels of these governments have been looking for a way to cool tensions. Even if, and I think this is an important point, even if people on both sides are not really willing to do the things that would actually prevent the trajectory,
right
off of a trajectory towards conflict. So I think the balloon is just sort of, obviously China has a spying program on the United States. It's come out since the balloon that this is a fairly large spying program that has conducted surveillance on a number, dozens of countries. So I think and there's also been some reporting that this balloon may have been meant to conduct surveillance over Guam in the South Pacific, and wind patterns just forced it into the territorial United States. So I think the odds are likely that this was someone messed something up or something went wrong. The Chinese government did not want a diplomatic incident at this point. And in fact, their response when the balloon was first made public was very unusual expression of regret that the balloon had gone, as they said, gone off course. And so I think the odds are that both sides have been sort of pushed off course by the balloon. It is because the relationship has deteriorated this badly that something so minor and comical as a balloon could do that.
Yeah, and I frankly put a lot of the blame on the United States attempting to drum up it's the Republicans, but frankly, like, Chuck Schumer has had this China competition bill in the works for years at this point, ended up getting passed in the form of the CHIPS Act, and there is a growing consensus among both parties. It's like probably the only bipartisan consensus right now in Washington that domestically being hawkish on China is beneficial. And I find that to be concerning given the fact that our Cold War with Russia hasn't even really fully ended. And it's time for us to start one up again with China. And a lot of this started, right, with Biden soon into his presidency forging that deal with Australia, right, where there was that submarine deal. Then again, adding more military exercises later last year with Australia in order to ramp up our presence there closer to China. And weeks before this balloon news, the deal that Lloyd Austin struck, I believe, in the Philippines, where we've reopened a few military bases that were defunct, but from our time of colonialism in the Philippines. And that is meant, obviously, to be a provocation or a flexing of our muscle with China. And China just, the United States has hundreds of military bases around the world, and some we don't even know about. It's hundreds that we know about. How many does China have in comparison?
It has one military base outside.
Right. So it just,
it's in Djibouti. So
yeah.
In the Horn of Africa, you know, which is a sensitive place, but certainly does not pose any threat to the United States.
So with all of my prelude there, I mean, if you don't mind just talking about the United States' kind of concerted effort to expand its military presence outside of China and what that reaction has been, or I should say in proximity to China, and what the reaction has been within China, how that's informed this deterioration of a relationship.
Yeah, that's a really essential part of the dynamic here. A lot of times the discussion in D.C., wants to blame everything on Chinese actions and say that the United States is only responding defensively. I think in the mind of a lot of the policymakers, that's true. They feel like they're responding defensively to aggressive Chinese moves. But, you know, it looks exactly the same from Beijing's perspective, but reversed. They think that what they're doing that's being interpreted as aggressive moves in Washington are defensive moves to guard against the United States encircling and containing and China militarily and potentially splitting Taiwan from China permanently, potentially preventing the Chinese economy from developing. So right now we're sort of stuck in a feedback loop between the two sides, right? By no means do I want to whitewash the Chinese government. The internal record of the Chinese government within China is atrocious in many ways. It's a very, very oppressive system. Its external posture, while not as aggressive as any other major power, it has become more nationalist in its external posture in recent years. And you can understand why people in the region might be a little nervous about it. So some of the moves that the Biden administration have been making in the right context would be sort of prudent, ways to just to make sure that things don't go wrong. The problem is that set of moves is the only thing that the United States is doing. The U.S. relationship with China is all about sort of making China feel besieged. It's about, as you say, about encircling it with military bases. Also really important change from Trump to Biden is it's about rebuilding American alliances and increasingly focusing those alliances on China, including NATO, before the Russian invasion of Ukraine caused NATO to return its attention to Europe. So you know, we have to think about how this looks in Beijing. Beijing is a rising power. It has aspirations for its status in the global system, what it wants to do in the world. It certainly wants to keep its economy growing and create good jobs for its people. Those are, I think, legitimate aspirations, and we need to have a world in which those aspirations can be realized in a way that's not threatening to other people. By the U.S., by pursuing an imbalanced approach, one that is purely focused on deterring potential Chinese aggression, without the kinds of initiatives and outreach that would integrate China into the global system that the United States is still the leader of, and without the cooperative projects around shared global problems that would give the two countries a shared stake in the success of both countries, right? Like right now, each country feels like for the other country to succeed means that our country is losing, is under threat. And that's an extraordinarily dangerous situation to have when you're talking about the two most powerful countries in the world. Both countries need to understand that they can only succeed if the other country succeeds. And if we can't get the relationship to a position like that, then we really are headed towards very serious conflict.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of an interesting contrast in the way that these powers, though, are positioning themselves, right? Because I feel that the United States is a bit of a bloated empire that doesn't really know how to show its might in any way at this point in its history outside of military presence and power. And yeah. China, they're, it's really, yes, there's surveillance, of course, but they're kind of positioning themselves in an opposite manner and leaning into a more economic powerhouse model, which is really, I think, what terrifies people in Washington, is the loss of supremacy over international markets. But at the same time, these CHIPS acts and these moves to move things onshore, which I think some of that is good, but some of the hawkishness is really bad, kind of severs the relationship economically even more. Would you say that that drives some of the nationalism that you're seeing in China?
Oh yes, no question. The point that you make, that some of the industrial policy that the Biden administration has put in place is an important and overdue response to the failure of free market economics over the last 30 years to give a decent life to people in the United States. The problem is attaching the important and welcome forms of economic involvement of the government, attaching that to the idea that the reason we have to do this is not to make people's lives in America better. The reason we have to do this is because China is trying to destroy our country and democracy around the world. And that's the reason we have to do that. So the politics around that, this is really hard. The Biden administration is looking for places that it can work with the Republicans. The Republicans will get on board for a hawkish approach, particularly on China. So you can see why this path was attractive to the Biden administration to take. But the place that it is moving us towards is orienting our entire society around confrontation with the other country. Right. And this is true on the Chinese side as well. The more that the Chinese leadership feels that the United States has a plan to keep China down and to contain it and to prevent economic growth in China, then the more the Chinese government feels it needs to organize its society around confronting the United States. And as those things are institutionalized, as the kind of the ideology of foreign threat and defining the other country as the biggest problem of our country, as those get deeper, they will more and more force us into conflict with the other side, even as they involve increasing oppression within each country. Like in China, of course, oppression has gotten worse over the last 10 years. But the danger is that in the United States, this also could happen, right? Like people who reject the consensus that we have to organize our society around confronting this other country, those people will face oppression, right? And that could be people who are identified with China for some way because of their race, because they're East Asian. It could be leftists who say that we shouldn't be organizing our society around nationalism, international conflict, right? There's a very real, and certainly the American history is just replete with cases.
Red Scare 2.0, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Well, right.
3.0, right?
3.0. Oh, sorry about that. Speaking of some of what this might drum up domestically for China, what is your read on how the past few years, the increase, the escalation has affected the Taiwan situation? Pelosi visiting there from an American perspective, right? Like that seemed like it was not the smartest move, but, as that nationalism and repression kind of ramps up, what's happening right now with Taiwan?
Yeah, I mean it's the deterioration in the relationship between the U.S. and China that has taken Taiwan from being a non-issue, something that everyone was willing to kind of tolerate, this weird situation that the country was in, has taken that from being a non-issue to the most likely issue to start World War III that we have in the world right now. So I think the first thing to say is that we have to understand that Taiwan can't be solved by focusing on Taiwan. The challenge that this issue poses to both the U.S. and China, and of course most directly to the people of Taiwan, that cannot be solved by focusing on Taiwan. The solution to this problem ultimately lies in finding a solid foundation for the U.S.-China relationship. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is, and it's a difficult issue to kind of understand. Because from, I think from the perspective of the people of Taiwan themselves and from perspective of most outsiders, this is a self-governing country that has been self-governing for decades and decades. The people do not want to unify with China. And for, for 40 years since the U.S. switched recognition of, from the government on Taiwan to the Chinese government in Beijing, this hasn't been an issue. So I think it's hard for people to fully appreciate what's driving this. So I don't want to say that I sympathize with China's position on this, but it is important to understand that the claim on Taiwan is a bedrock part of Chinese nationalism, and that the Chinese government, for both ideological and for practical reasons, will not tolerate the possibility of Taiwan becoming permanently separated from the Chinese claim on it. So that could happen through a formal declaration of Taiwanese independence. It could happen through a formalization of kind of the U.S. military relationship with Taiwan. Right now, there's an extensive military relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan, but it's all sort of done informally. There are no American bases there, unlike most of the rest of the world. So the key issue here is, does the Chinese government think that Taiwan is on a road to permanent separation or not? And if we can maintain this weird status quo where China makes this claim on Taiwan, but the Taiwan itself is self-governing and no one else in the region is kind of pushing to change any of this, if we can maintain that weird status quo, then things would be okay. But the only way to maintain that status quo is for the two sides to trust that the other side is not trying to undermine the status quo. And right now, neither side thinks that. Both sides think the other side is trying to change the status quo. And that's a product of the deterioration in the relationship itself, because we no longer trust anything the other side says.
What was the impact of Pelosi's visit overstated or understated? I mean, or just another piece of that escalation that you describe?
I think it was part of, I mean, it's sort of intensified it. It was very provocative. It was a really senseless kind of move. It didn't achieve anything to make Taiwan safer. It just made the Chinese government extremely angry. It exacerbated nationalism in China. And it gave the Chinese military an excuse to sort of practice what it would be like to blockade Taiwan. So I think it was an overall loss, but it did. I think you're right to point to that it's part of the existing trajectory. It wasn't something that changed. Like, things were fine before that. It's just part of this rising escalation that we're getting on both sides.
Right. Lastly, we had a viewer write in. Mike from Bavaria says, "Can you ask about the Open Skies Treaty? And I guess how the United States' withdrawal from that treaty, I guess, was that under Trump? How that might have impacted this whole balloon saga before I let you go."
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the Open Skies Treaty was a treaty between the U.S. and Russia specifically, and then there were some other parties to it. China has been much more reluctant to reach those kind of agreements. For example, the arms control infrastructure that the U.S. and the Soviet Union put together during the Cold War, and that stuck around for a while, although Trump disassembled a lot of what was left. But China has never engaged in those kinds of arms control agreements with the United States. The claim being, the United States and Russia have, you know, 100 times, or, you know, 10 times as many nuclear weapons as China does. China's expanding its nuclear arsenal, but even if it expands at the current fairly fast rate, it would take about 100 years to reach the number of nuclear weapons that the United States currently has. So China has always said, like, you know, if you want to reduce your nuclear weapons to the level that we have, then we can talk. And there's something similar for things like the Open Skies Treaty. Like, the Soviet Union, and the Open Skies Treaty only came into effect after the Soviet Union was gone, but it's part of this sort of trajectory of Cold War agreements. The Soviet Union had this capability to kind of match American efforts. So the Soviet Union and afterwards Russia, could actually fly surveillance missions. You know, the equivalent of U-2 spy planes could fly those over the United States. China has not done that. So the balloons is sort of a cheap way to accomplish some of that. That and a satellite fleet is the focus of Chinese over air surveillance of the United States. The United States, meanwhile, flies hundreds of spy planes very close to the Chinese mainland, and does its surveillance that way. In addition to spy satellites, I think the point to make about surveillance espionage is that this is something that every country does. The United States does it to China. It also does it to its allies. You know, there was a scandal,
Merkel,
less than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. When it came out that the United States had been bugging Merkel's cell phone. So this is something that this is just part of the game. Yeah. You know, it's fine to take measures, prudent measures to guard against it. You don't want to just give away all your secrets by any means, but it's part of the game. It's not something to make an excuse to turn a relationship that does not have to lead to conflict to push that closer towards conflict.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. It just, it feels like there's no momentum to oppose this domestically because it's...
The politics is really hard.
There's too much... Yeah, there's too much money in the bank and like the door's wide open and, you know, but you're pointing at all of like these bars of gold for politicians. I mean, it's a bad metaphor, yeah. But and saying don't take it. It's just... I mean, well, I think also, we should be immensely concerned. Yeah.
There's a lot of fear in Washington that if you say anything like, you know, things that I think regular Americans would find totally reasonable, like it's important to cooperate with China on things like climate change and pandemics and, you know, the drug trade and like all these things, it's important to do that. Or, you know, if you say things like that, you put yourself at risk of running into this attack machine that is like, oh, here's a stooge of the Chinese Communist Party. So people are either keeping quiet or they're preemptively coming out as tough on China. And that just moves the goalposts further towards conflict. And this is something that, you know, and in addition to that, there's a lot of people who are like, this is the one thing that will get legislation through Congress. So I'm going to attach my agenda to anti-China stuff. Like no matter how implausible this is, I'm going to say the thing that I want to pass legislatively is the thing that's going to help us beat China. And so that means that everyone in D.C. is like, OK, well, we have to be anti-China. Mm-hmm. So the space to do something productive in the relationship has really closed down. And that is affecting people in the Biden administration as well. They're afraid to do things that otherwise would totally make sense. Right. So I think it is important to note that this is something about DC. It's not something about the country as a whole. Most people in the United States do not think we have to have a serious conflict with China. Most people do not think China is actually one of the top five issues that is facing the country. And there are a lot of people who really stand to lose if they get caught in between a serious conflict. Of course, everyone stands to lose if we turn our entire society in a military direction. But there are a lot of specific, really important agendas, whether that's climate groups, whether that's Asian American groups, a lot of people in both business and labor, they would really lose from a serious conflict with China. And the thing that those of us who are working on this issue are trying to do is trying to get them to articulate that clearly, to create a counter power in Washington that can stand up against the move towards international conflict and open up some space so that it's not so scary for politicians to say the right thing on this stuff.
Well, I couldn't agree with that mission more. Jake Werner, co-founder of Justice's Global Historian, researcher for the Quincy Institute. Thanks so much for taking the time coming on and explaining all this to us. Really appreciate
it. Yeah, great talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. All right, folks, with that, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, everybody, the Emajority shirts, the pre-sale. It's not going to last, folks. It's not going to last. Limited sale runs until this Sunday night. Until midnight, you have to go to shop.majorityreportradio.com to get those A Majority Report shirts. You got them in clay, powder blue, fun stuff. Check that out and get them while you can, plus some other merch as well. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, on Left Reckoning, we had a good show, a packed show this weekend, talking about the train derailment in Vietnam and some Austin shenanigans. This weekend, we talked to Carl Baer about Ukraine, this Cy-Hurst stuff, and what we could learn from it. And so check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I am curious to I'm going to take and give a listen to that, because like, I've seen a lot of people trying to get us to weigh on the Cy Hirsch thing, and it's just...
Carl had a really great Substack on it that I thought was really measured and wasn't a rush to, I think, brand himself with...
No.
Either draping himself in Cy Hirsch or in the heroism of him, or... jumping to immediately discredit a guy who does have a history of well-sourced revelations. So I think we'll be trying to be measured about it for folks.
And today on ESPN, I lost, so I got to eat cheese. If you want to watch that, check it out. Try not to think about it.
Is the cheese here?
I actually brought a cheese stick from home.
Well, cheese stick. That's what I would do. I'd just eat cheese sticks the whole time.
I don't like them, so it's just...
Mozzarella? You don't?
No, no.
A moist, plastic cheese stick.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bradley might get something extra terrible.
With the consistency of a Lego.
All right, all right. Yeah, thank you.
A wet Lego.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, check that out, youtube.com/ESPN show today. It'll be, it's like something unlike anything I've ever done on camera. That sounded weird. Hey, guys, we got Brandon and Binder. There, well.
Hello.
It's magic. What's up, guys?
I'm sorry to hear about your cheese issue.
Yeah, it is a situation. I just, Bradley and I had like a competition for ESPN. Picks against the spread, and I lost. So this is my punishment, and it's going to be televised. The punishment will be televised.
The punishment is eating cheese.
Yes, it is. It is. We picked our least.
It is a horrible punishment. I mean, I think it's on the level with some of the worst crimes against humanity that can possibly be.
Matt
be
Binder
explained.
Understands. Yes,
I get
does.
It. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I'm one of the few here who understand based on having eaten cheese and not enjoying it myself.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yikes, guys.
It is a yikes. But with that said, my friends, Matt Binder, what's happening on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Well, this week on Doomed, I spoke with Christopher Mathias of Huffington Post, where we got into the details of one of his newest reports about a online homeschooling group that teaches kids, parents of kids who are homeschooled, how to teach their kids to be Nazis. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? We looked through the lesson plans, which are unbelievable, how an anti-fascist group was able to out these formerly anonymous parents who ran this group of over 3,000 people. We get into a lot of details there. I definitely encourage people to check that out at youtube.com/Matt Binder. And shortly as a podcast, it'll be up on the podcast feed too at doomcast.com. And Scam Economy, I spoke with one Brandon Sutton last week about the crypto Super Bowl ads, and there will be a new Scam Economy episode coming very soon in the coming days. So stay tuned to the same YouTube channel and scameconomy.com for that.
And
the
allow
lack
me
of
to...
Super Bowl crypto ads, you should say, right?
Yeah. It was, we looked at, when we recorded last week, we looked at where the companies who did have all those Super Bowl ads last year have gone and what they're up to. And then we also discussed how there were no crypto ads booked for the Super Bowl this year. It was pretty amazing, actually, to not even see. There wasn't even like a hint at one, or like, I remember after the .com bubble, there was at least like one commercial that joked about all the .com companies that had advertised the previous year. This year, no one even wanted to touch it. It wasn't, crypto was just not mentioned at all.
Very, very interesting. What could have caused that?
No idea. I guess listen to Scam Economy and you'll find out.
I think, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, but I think, you know, amongst all the rambling and misinformation about and FUD, I should say, there were a few nuggets of insight there. You know, like when we called out how the industry was getting cut off from their traditional banking channels, and then that's just been the news of the past, you know, week and a half of like a lot of these companies now, you know, being hit with SEC Wells notices or being hit with other types of actions by financial regulators. So,
The regulators are finally coming hard at crypto. You know, it's not going to be a good year for the crypto exchanges, that's for sure, or the lenders or anyone involved in blockchain, really.
Oh, a good year for Scam Economy, though.
That's true.
Yeah, just don't take any crypto ad money because they might claw it back during bankruptcy trials. That's the real reason why they canceled the ads, because it's like, well, what's the point of taking $1 million?
Actually, FTX has actually sent out letters to the political
campaigns
that FTX donated to, requesting that they return the money.
I saw that.
FTX donated. Now, here's the thing. Some of those campaigns, actually, when this first went down in November, they straight up, like, without even, like, on their own, I mean, not because they're so kind, but because it looked bad, they donated the same amount of money that SBF had donated to them, FTX had donated to them, to charities. So now here FTX is asking them to refund the money to them. I'm assuming they're going to have to do that, and they're going to end up getting hit. I'm not, like, you know, playing the world's tiniest violin for these campaigns, but it is still funny to see.
Yeah. Brandon, what's happening over on the Discourse?
New episode of the Discourse out on SoundCloud. I put it up a few days ago. Zero Dark Blue 30. It's about my love of the new Avatar movie and imperialism. So check it out. We'll have a new episode out this weekend too. We're getting back onto the cycle of putting out content, the content creation cycle, CCC.
Yeah, it's I mean,
C triple C.
You gotta get on the on that train. Never, it never stops, the content.
But, content as a service is the new model.
646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh no! Oh, no! Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Black. Come on. Black. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.